Welcome back from another topsy-turvy week with a lot of news. I was getting ready for this episode and I needed like urgent AI assistance and like a timeline because so many things happened and so many things changed from day to day and even hour to hour. Murat, how was your week?
Well, everything busying, but it was a pretty good week. How about you?
Good. Puppy is keeping me busy, but I think Trump and Zelensky and Putin are keeping us much, much busier. So we'll get right into it. I did have a show on Thursday. I hope a lot of you tuned in for that. That's the show with Nick. We went over some of this stuff, so it might be a little bit of a repeat. But with Murat, I really like to dig into the more historical geopolitical stuff with Nick. It kind of just is a lot of making fun of what's going on and trying to bring levity to the situation. But so we had on Tuesday, once again, we're trying to placate Russia by saying we might recognize Crimea, to which Zelensky replies, absolutely not. Crimea will not be ceded. It is against their constitution. So that leaves that out of the equation. Not that I think that it would really matter if Trump recognized Crimea, but he did take Truth Social and said, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is boasting on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that Ukraine will not legally recognize the occupation of Crimea. There's nothing to talk about here. Trump goes on to say that the statement was very harmful to peace negotiations, again, mentioning that Barack Obama is the one who started the war. He calls it the Obama handover of Crimea, which is quite hilarious. But then he goes on to say the statement made by Zelensky today will do nothing but prolong the killing field. And nobody wants that. We are very close to a deal, but the man with no cards to play should now finally get it done. I look forward to being able to help Ukraine and Russia get out of this complete and total mess that would have never started if I were president. Again, Murat, what do you think of that statement? Every day we're close to a deal. We're so close to a deal and somebody screws it up. This time it's Zelensky.
Yeah, I mean, I know ultimately it's like we're getting close to the end of this. But Trump, and I know it's good for Russia, but like just as an American resident, Trump is such a bad mediator. Like he just stacks... he just loads everything or stacks the deck, and everything he says just always feels like loaded language. It feels to me like this is just a way to add this statement. Essentially, you present bad deals, or that these are deals that are stacked one way, and you're just kind of like, I don't know, we're waiting on Zelensky. I don't know, everyone's ready. Just we're waiting on Volodymyr. And so, I mean, essentially what happens here is it's going to be that, Zelensky's going to have to agree to a deal here, and it's going to be a deal he doesn't want, but he's going to be, he's going to be who the blame is hung on after all this, so that, it's not going to be Trump's fault, of course, it's not going to be America's fault. It's only going to be all on Zelensky for, accepting the deal, but he really does not have any other card to play. So I get Trump is correct on that point. Now, as for the meeting, real quick, I wanted to say that that 15-minute meeting they had at the Pope's funeral.
We're not there. No spoilers, Murat. We got a long way to go. We're still on. That's Wednesday. They didn't meet the Pope until Saturday. So in between Wednesday and the being close to a deal, Putin shows that they're very, very close to a deal. So we know the Russians' response. then Trump, I guess it catches Trump by surprise. Good to hear his response.
What concessions, Mr. President, and to your national security team, what concessions has Russia offered up thus far to get to the point where you're closer to peace?
Stopping the war, stopping taking the whole country. Pretty big concession.
Russia is conceding to stop the war and to stop taking the whole country. Not that I ever thought that that was Russia's plan, but Trump has stopped them from doing so. So that's good news, I think.
It's like, this is why he's the worst. It's just like, well, we stopped. The good news is we stopped this unlikely thing that was never going to happen anyway from happening.
Stop them from taking Kiev. They're not going to take Lviv anymore, guys. I stopped that. They would have taken it if Kamala Harris was in office. They would have taken it. Lavrov goes on CBS the same day for a, not very often does he do mainstream media Western interview. So that was pretty interesting. But I do want to play this clip because it's so Lavrov.
But he did say there was a deal and that he was sending his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to meet with Vladimir Putin Friday in Russia. Is that meeting still happening? And should we expect a deal this week?
Well, you don't trust the word of the President of the United States?
Everybody, the only people that think there's a deal are the Americans. And so it's really incredible. What do you think that, like, is Trump just banking on the fact that Americans will believe him? Or does he just kind of just say it because that's what's good to say at the time?
Well, they certainly, there's a good portion of Americans that do believe him on a lot of what he says or anything he says. And also, this is like, we're kind of in the Biden zone with him mentally, like just in terms of like, he just has no idea what's going on. But he's also like more chatty than Biden. So he'll just rip off like, you know, just some freestyle thought and just kind of hopes it sticks. And this is kind of like, this is the pattern with him. It's like he just goes off like, you know, whatever comes to mind or whatever you heard last. And so what I wanted to say with like that, the meeting with when he did catch Zelensky at the funeral, it's like the last thing he hears is what he goes with. You know, after that meeting, he's like, well, maybe Russia doesn't want to stop the war. And when he tweets the Vladimir, stop.
The like, recency bias. Whatever the most recent, that's what we'll just go with.
Yeah, yeah. It's maddening to watch from the sides. Just to, you know, and then when he pats himself on the back as this like great peacemaker, I mean, I don't know. It seems like they're just kind of hoping for something, and they have nothing that they can do about it.
Do you think that it's more frustrating for you to watch this because maybe I know for me, and maybe even more so for you, you understand Eastern or Eurasian culture a little bit better than the average Westerner. So is it you that are you kind of like, this isn't the right way to even be approaching this? Like, it just feels like they don't even know who they're really talking to.
Yeah. And maybe even on a diplomatic level, culture doesn't matter as much because there's a sort of like global diplomatic culture that everyone has to follow for these processes. It's just mattering for like, as an American, for how dumb like they think we are, like when they kind of present things on this level. It's a war, you know, so it is serious. And so sometimes like when it's, this kind of commentary kind of leads one to believe that it's not like being treated as seriously, as they say, in their foreign policy or just, you know, for American interests. But yeah, it is frustrating to say the least. I know he's a very entertaining president, but so for me.
Well, the content's great. There's never going to be a week where we're like, I really don't know what to talk about. It's a slow news week. So that's the net positive of Trump. So finally, we're at Friday. We haven't even gotten to the Pope's funeral. We're at Friday.
Skipping ahead, I'm sorry.
And the bomb. No, I'm just saying, like, that's how much has happened. We're 15 minutes into the episode and we're not even to the Pope's funeral, which was probably the biggest part. But yesterday or 2 days ago, Friday for us, a car bomb goes off in Moscow. It kills a general, General Yaroslav Moskalik, deputy head of the Russian General Staff's main operations directorate. He's killed in a car bombing as he's driving home. A 2000 Volkswagen Golf was rigged with a shrapnel bomb and gas canisters as accelerants. So this is pretty major. The vehicle was unregistered in Russia, couldn't be found in Russian databases, and had changed hands three times with links to a man originally from Sumy. So this is this was really interesting because Russia, of course, takes the pragmatic sort of stance and says it's nothing. It's not linked to anything. But timing is of everything. And it's the same day that Witkoff's to arrive in Russia. What are your thoughts about this sort of occurrence? Is this more vanilla ISIS?
My thoughts on this, I mean, I didn't know General Moskalik by name, but what it strikes me as is Ukraine is trying out a more a drastic strategy where they're just going in for these sort of terrorist attacks, extracurricular attacks, however you want to call it, but just sort of not off the battlefield way of warring, which is coming after high-ranking officers or politicians, etc. This may be the strategy. I don't know. I don't know if this will be the beginning of a pattern, but that was kind of what it felt like to me. What about you?
Same. I just was wondering if you had an initial reaction, because obviously the perpetrator did confess later, but the initial reaction to Russia very quickly stating this has nothing to do with it. It's probably just a kind of an accident. I just thought that was interesting, especially since we'll talk about another explosion occurring in a volatile area later, that all the government is once again kind of saying, this isn't terrorism. This one winds up being the man confesses that it was a terrorist attack that he was paid to do. So just wanted to know your initial reaction.
Yeah. I thought that was going to be kind of, there were going to be more copycat attacks in something similar, because that's a wave. When you're up against a stronger opponent, you tend to look for asymmetrical ways to mm-hmm. earn that. So I thought we would see that more often. I'm glad we had it, but I also I'm rooting for this conflict to end. I would hope not, but yeah, we'll see if there's other ways that Ukraine can get by the Russian defenses in this way.
Same day.
How are you, Mr. President?
Very anxious, thank you. Thank you.
So good to see you.
Interpreter? From the embassy. Okay.
So not pulling out his chair like Trump does for Bibi, but still looked pretty happy to see Witkoff there, other than the fact that the talks, this is the fourth visit, by the way, the talks produced little to nothing. They just said that they were constructive, and following the meeting, Putin said he was open to talks, and then Trump was taking off to go to Rome. Now you can go off about the funeral in one second. Trump goes to Rome, and on the way, he on Truth Social states, let me get the tweet, just landed in Rome. A good day in talks and meetings with Russia and Ukraine. They are very close to a deal, and the two sides should now meet at very high levels to finish it off. Most of the major points are agreed to. Stop the bloodshed now. We will be wherever is necessary to help facilitate the end to this cruel, senseless war. And then he gets to have his meeting with Zelensky. What was it about the meeting with Zelensky that you thought was, did you like the part where he kind of pushes Macron and tells him to go somewhere else?
Well, real quick on Witkoff, that was his fourth trip. So I was gonna tell him, I heard you get the fifth one free if you buy four, you get it. So he's been going so often there, right?
This stamp card.
Yeah, so regarding the Zelensky thing, I mean, Zelensky had to have been prepped for this meeting, and I mean, why not? And with the intel that just flatter him, just tell him, and so whatever it was, he flattered Trump, probably got his 15 minutes that he got to chat with him, it's what I said. It's whoever, the recency bias, whoever spoke to him last is what it seems like what he goes with. And so, seeing him come out and be like, well, maybe Vladimir doesn't want to, you know, maybe Vladimir doesn't want peace. Like this is mixed messaging. This was actually just a bad week for Trump in terms of his ability to project, you know, power or authority or just any sort of control in this matter. I think he's just being treated like just a guy, you know, just a dude who shows up and talks. So, but yeah, so that was a really annoying. I felt like from a little 15 minute meeting, just passing by Zelensky, that, you know, you come back and you have a little bit different messaging.
Well, what's interesting is that that's the first time that they've seen each other face to face since the "Have you even said thank you" in the White House. So that's the first time. And to a little side note, while all of this is going on, Russia releases this video and the news that that was a terrorist attack.
Я Кузин Игнат Витальевич, 1983 года рождения. Был завербован украинскими спецслужбами куратором Вадимом в Киевской области. В 2023 году в апреле месяце. В 2023 году в сентябре по его указаниям я уехал в Москву. В ноябре 2024 года я заселился по его указанию, которую, ну, оплачивал непосредственно он. В 2025 году в феврале я купил автомобиль Volkswagen Universal также по его указаниям и по его координатам. В конце февраля 2025 года по его координатам я нашел тайник и забрал оттуда видеокамеру и бомбу, которую я установил на заднюю ляду автомобиля. Взрыв был непосредственно произведен дистанционно куратором Вадимом.
So we have a confession from another member of Vanilla ISIS, as we like to call them here, and Zelensky is getting the red carpet treatment in the Vatican.
There is President Zelensky.
His image is being shown on a monitor in, and that's why you hear people actually applauding now. They're applauding President Zelensky.
So apparently, and this is apparently a big deal, who knew, they break protocol at the Vatican to give Zelensky a special seat. Apparently, they seat world leaders according to their country alphabetically, in Italian, obviously. And so that would have put Zelensky back a couple, like a few rows back, obviously, 11 seats. And so they moved him all the way to the front so he could be near Macron and Trump on the morning that a terrorist attack has been admitted from his country. What do you kind of make of this kind of juxtaposition? Oh, somebody said, there you go. Natalie says Vatican is playing with the Nazi crowd as usual.
Well, if that really was strategy on their part, I mean, I do have to hand it to the Vatican. I mean, for at least like thinking forward on that one. I don't know. I mean, I guess there's some, you know, it is interesting that the Vatican would do this, but like stuff like this kind of bothers me less in a sense of like someone would try it, because I do think that like they probably wanted to give Zelensky, you know, that sort of the opportunity to do that or the opportunity to speak with Trump if he had the chance. But like, yeah, I mean, it's, did it bother you, or do you think it's?
I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know. I really.
I think the protocol itself is, you know, it's interesting, but like I find these kinds of things more like more fascinating in a historical sense, because if it works, then yeah, good thinking, you know,
kind of like a cultural, like, whatever. But so you did mention their statements after Zelensky's official statement was good meeting. We discussed the protection of our people, full and unconditional ceasefire, reliable and lasting peace. Very symbolic meeting that has the potential to become historic. So a symbolic meeting? It didn't. Was it just a formality?
There is this sort of like a cynical effect you get, because you feel like everyone's BSing, right? Because like Zelensky is playing up how well the meeting went, and then Russia will kind of come out and say, no, we had a great meeting, or, you know, obviously with Witkoff and stuff. So everyone's having great meetings or positive developments. And then when you hear from Trump, it's like, did this guy like even listen to anyone? So, everyone's going to say what they say, you know, certainly this was a minor W for Zelensky, just in a sense of like face, you know, for back home in Ukraine. For now, this is just a little piece of theater we get to kind of keep us in suspense.
And like you said a few times, and I'll just read it again for the audience, Donald Trump did take to Truth Social to write a very long, scathing message for little Peter Baker of the New York Times. But at the end, he's also calling it the Obama Crimea giveaway. But anyway, in the last paragraph, he says, with all of that being said, there was no reason for Putin to be shooting missiles into civilian areas, cities, and towns over the last few days. It makes me think that maybe he doesn't want to stop the war. He's just tapping me along and has to be dealt with differently through banking or secondary sanctions. Too many people are dying. What's he going to do to Putin?
Yeah. What of Trump's like master strokes that he does is when he does something that's like already been done, but he makes it sound like he came up with it. And he's just like with the JCPOA that he's going to redo again. He's just like,
right,
we're going to do to Russia, we're going to do sanctions. And Russia's like, oh, wow, we had not heard that before.
Or when they were, even when they said we might recognize Crimea, and Russia was like, oh, really? Like, oh, thank God. Like, thank you for 11 years later. Like, nobody cares. It's so funny.
And just also, what banking sanctions? Is there any further sanctions to put on Russia? Like, I don't know how further we go.
The thing is that if once you start with secondary sanctions, you've lost. If you have to start sanctioning the people that are doing business with the people that you've sanctioned, then you're starting to get real. It shows a really huge amount of desperation. It's a very bad sign. So countries like to avoid that at all costs. That's why he's kind of sort of probably floating that idea a little bit. He does that a lot. You know, we talk about it every day on Twitter and Spaces, that he floats these crazy ideas, a 2028 hat, a secondary sanctions in quotes, just to kind of see how people are going to react or to give them sort of fodder. Something like that. But no, we don't have any secondary sanctions. They've done some petty ones to sanction individuals that nobody's ever heard of, dumb things like that, restricted travel, but no secondary sanctions. That's something that they try to avoid at all cost. But I think the biggest news about Ukraine, Russia this week comes from Kursk, site of yet another historic battle. Let's see what Putin has to say.
Поздравляю весь личный состав всех воинских подразделений, принимавших участие в разгроме неонацистских формирований, вторгшихся на российскую территорию в Курской области. Авантюра киевского режима полностью провалилась, а понесенные противником огромные потери, в том числе и среди наиболее боеспособных, подготовленных и оснащенных в том числе и западными образцами техники силами ВСУ, а это штурмовые подразделения, спецназ, безусловно, отразятся на всей линии боевого соприкосновения. Полный разгром противника в Курском приграничье создает условия для дальнейших успешных действий наших войск и на других важнейших участках фронта, приближает разгром неонацистского режима.
So I wanted to play that in its entirety because I wanted your thoughts about the We know that Putin speaks certain ways for a purpose. He doesn't mince words. He chooses words wisely and precisely. He called them neo-Nazis twice in there, which, I mean, yeah, it could be seen as a little bit cringe. But I thought that was significant because of the location. It is at Kursk. He mentioned that they were well-trained, obviously, but he was sure to point out that they have Western equipment. And he also mentioned that this actually gives them more advantage across the whole entire line of contact, suggesting that we're close to a deal. We're talking about how much better the line of contact looks. So what are your thoughts on all of those things?
Yeah, and the line from Putin, you know, I can kind of expect this for now because, of course, Russia is going to just try to maximize their leverage. And so he has no reason to sound like he's happy or satisfied yet. I mean, why? Even if you are, why not just act like you're not? You know, Kursk, obviously, you know, very significant. This was a big story when it started in August. This was like a new, you know, offensive for Ukraine. There's historical significance there. The Battle of Kursk in, you know, World War II was critical and kind of stays in Russian memory. Remember when it happened when Ukraine first went for Kursk? I didn't ask you your thoughts then, but like when it happened, did you think like this was a very reckless move by Ukraine? Like, what did you think of it?
It's funny because Borut or Area, he said that we all said that this whole time. I mean, it was very transparent what it was. It was an effort to try to stretch the Russians thin along the Donbas line, and it just didn't pan out that way. And they wound up having to feed this sort of meat grinder. I mean, it was very silly. You could tell, like, kind of not haphazard, but unprofessional and weird that it was. They're looting gas stations and stuff like that. There was no military plan, no strategy to hold the place. No, it was just very strange. They have a very strange way of, and it felt like violence for the sake of violence. It didn't feel like it had any purpose. And that's why I think that, we kind of knew from the beginning that with having no direction and there being no plan and it not even close to accomplishing what they wanted it to was to just thin out that front line. It was hopeless from the beginning. I mean, but this has been going on since September. So over 6 months of this.
Yeah. I remember thinking like there was speculation almost that this was something that America had kind of suggested to Ukraine to almost to kind of stab them in the back to hurry up this process of wrapping up this war, because it just kind of felt like that. Now, when we see this week that, you know, they lose Kursk, and this is a big chip they were holding in the case of some kind of thing to trade for, you know, the territory concessions you're going to have to make, and now they lose that chip. So they don't even have the Kursk thing anymore to negotiate with. So very big loss for Ukraine there. And yeah, it was a meat grinder. I mean, it ultimately, you know, it just was a sinkhole to nothing. And I had heard that, so you probably know this even better than me, but like the Ukraine is switching to a more like drone heavy strategy. I was reading analysis on how the strategy is switching to something that's primarily, you know, it utilizes less manpower, and it also draws in more manpower from the other side. So it serves Ukraine's needs for right now. But was that the American equipment Putin was referring to? Was the drones?
Probably not. They found a lot of Western vehicles in the Kursk offensive and Western weapons. But I'm not sure about drones. I'm not very good with drone warfare. I only know about Russian drones, Lancets and the like. But yeah, I know that they were making a lot of sort of like rigged, like jerry-rigged drones. They were building a lot of sort of homemade-ish drones, and then they were getting some more like light drones from the West. But I'm not sure if I don't know if that's what he was referring to. But another announcement came out of Kursk from Gerasimov. So let's take a look. I want your reaction to this.
Отдельно хочу отметить участие в освобождении приграничных районов Курской области военнослужащих Корейской Народной Демократической Республики, которые в соответствии с договором о всеобъемлющем стратегическом партнерстве между нашими странами оказали значительную помощь в разгроме вклинившейся группировки вооруженных сил Украины. Солдаты и офицеры Корейской народной армии, выполняя боевые задачи плечом к плечу с российскими военнослужащими, в ходе отражения украинского вторжения показали высокий профессионализм, проявили в бою стойкость, мужество и героизм.
Why do you think he decided to admit that there are DPRK soldiers in Kursk after the liberation of the area? Do you think it was sort of a tongue-in-cheek? Or, I mean, I kind of got that vibe. He's not a humorous guy, but kind of like, and I want to say thanks to the Koreans that you guys have been talking about this whole time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I didn't think of it as insignificant or like in an ironic sense. I did think it was a big announcement. There was a lot of speculation about this for months now. I just read it as them not feeling like they need to hide that anymore. I don't know if I felt irony, but it was surprising that they revealed that. It seemed like they weren't interested in confirming that for a while. But yeah, I mean, this sort of, not that it's a huge shock, but I guess there are, you know, closer ties between the DPRK and Russia and, you know, possibly further military cooperation. But I don't know if this turns the tides on any alliances, but yeah, I mean, it is a big announcement.
Well, it's interesting that he obviously notes their bravery and professionalism, but it's interesting that we're getting battle experience, heavy battle. This is pretty serious in the Kursk region, heavy battle experience for North Korean troops, given what's going on their line of demarcation and what's been going on between them and the South.
So was that a way to kind of announce North Korea's war preparedness to kind of...
Well, that was kind of the hang-up. They were showing off their sort of artillery and missile preparedness. And everybody was always saying, well, you haven't fought a war since the 60s. And so maybe this is their way of kind of saying, well, that's what you thought. And I think people also need to understand, everybody, if North Korea does go to war, everybody becomes militarized. Every single man and woman above the age of 18 does serve in the military in a role. So you have an entire population that's now militarized. It's a different type of warfare that I don't think people are really going to be prepared for if that does happen. But now you have battle-hardened troops that can take... This is something that people always kind of make fun of the East Asians for in general, the North Koreans, the Chinese, even the Japanese, more so the Chinese than the North Koreans. They always say, you know, yeah, you have this great army, you have all this weapons, but you have no experience. And I think that we probably aren't that far off from maybe finding out there's some Chinese in the front lines other than the volunteers that we've already seen. I wouldn't be shocked, honestly, at this point. Speaking of Asia, let's go to the subcontinent. I know we don't want to, but we have to, because they're fighting over water and nobody understands what the hell's going on. I don't even think the people there understand what the hell's going on. But we do have a little recap for our listeners. So in case you guys missed it, there was a terrorist attack, suspicions on both sides of who's caused it. A terrorist group or some sort of militia did take credit and then backed off of that. Apparently five gunmen opened fire on an area in the Besaran Valley, which is in Kashmir, the Indian-administered part. 25 Indians were killed and one Nepalese. A group called the Resistance Front, they later retracted the claim, but they did admit that they had done it. India responds by expelling all Pakistani diplomats and suspending visa services for the nationals. And they closed the main border crossing. The sad part about that is we get no more high-kicking border crossing videos. So, guys, if you enjoyed the daily ceremony at the, I think it's the Atanji border, you will not be seeing them anymore. Very, very upset about that. But more importantly, they suspended the water treaty, the Indus Water Treaty. They placed it in abeyance. So this treaty has been in place since 1960. It was brokered by the World Bank, which I think this is a way for India to sort of challenge the World Bank. It divided the water into six rivers. And you can take a look right there. India was given the smaller eastern rivers. Pakistan was given the rights to the three largest rivers, which included 80% of the total water flow. India's obviously with India's gargantuan population growth, their demand for water obviously increases. Military actions increase along the borders. apparently security operations started India commenced border security operations in Kashmir and detained approximately 1500 individuals, demolishing homes. So quite a few different things happening. Pakistan obviously denied all responsibility and closed its airspace to Indian aircraft and suspended their trade. So they suspended the Simla Agreement, which is a 1971 agreement between India and Pakistan, coincidentally signed by Indira Gandhi and Ali Bhutto, two female, right? Was it?
Yeah,
two females. And they both agreed to resolve all issues, including Kashmir, with no third-party mediation, and they established a line of control, which is not a formally recognized border, but it was officially recognized, and they both agreed to respect it and to not use force to change it. Both armies have been exchanging fire along this line of control, and they have both increased troop deployments. Let's take a look at what the defense minister, the Pakistani defense minister, says of what could happen coming out of this, the suspension of the treaty and the suspension of the Simla Agreement, most importantly.
The serious breakdown. It is guaranteed by, it is underwritten by the World Bank, this treaty. They cannot abandon this treaty just like that. This is a serious blow to the relationship between the two countries. I think India should not be resorting to such measures. This will escalate the situation, and there's a possibility that there is an outbreak of all-out war, which will have serious repercussions, not only for our region, for our countries, but rest of the world also.
And
we will reach, we should refrain from that. We should take measures to stop any situation from flaring up to a level which will be irreversible.
And what message do you have to Donald Trump? Does he have a role to play in this and the United States?
Definitely, he leads the world power, the sole world power, and he has been, talking to different parties in different flashpoints all over the world, and this is also a flashpoint which has two nuclear powers daggers drawn with each other. I think the attention of the world should be drawn to this.
Well, Trump's got his full attention on it and full of knowledge. I'm going to play this because I know Murat really loved this video, and we'll get into it.
India and Pakistan, their intentions after the attack in Kashmir. Yeah. You got any message for them? Are you going to be talking to their leaders?
Very close to India and I'm very close to Pakistan, as you know. And they've had that fight for 1,000 years in Kashmir. Kashmir's been going on for 1,000 years, probably longer than that. And it was a bad one yesterday, though. That was a bad one. Over 30 people.
Are you concerned that there's now tensions on the border between them? Are you concerned about, how are you concerned are you about that?
Well, there have been tensions on that border for 1,500 years. So, you know, the same as it's been. But they'll get it figured out one way or the other. I'm sure that there's, I know both leaders. There's great tension between Pakistan and India, but there always has been.
Thousands of years!
You know what's funny is, like, at least when he said 1,000, they've been at war for 1,000 years, it's like, okay, in an ironic sense, you could be like, okay, like, Islam did reach the Indus River, 1,000 years ago, so, like, we could, you know, conceivably say that. Then he just follows it up, like, as if on purpose, 1,500, so just right before the advent of Islam, we're going to put... it's the start of this conflict. It's like so oddly specific too. It's like 1,500.
They'll figure it out.
Yeah.
They'll figure it out. No mediation. They've been arguing for thousands of years, but they'll figure it out. They've got it. I love that the Pakistani. Well, what do you think about J.D. Vance? Like, you know, obviously the curse of J.D. Vance. We're not all joking aside. This not for the irony, but he did go to India, and the message was sent to Modi the last time he was in the United States. He met with Trump after his inauguration, basically saying, like, that's your region, kind of giving him a lot of leeway to kind of do what he wants. The Pakistani defense minister and other officials have alluded to it maybe being a false flag or maybe being something that was encouraged to cause friction in that area to kind of put a wedge or to put a thorn in China's side. What are your thoughts with who really benefits from this sort of flare up in the tensions on in Kashmir? Because we do, for our listeners that don't know, there's a Chinese part of Kashmir, a Pakistani part, and an Indian part. So it's a very intricate situation.
Yeah, and when it happened, I did see, you know, speculation that you know, this may have had Chinese hands on it because they would benefit from this region flaring up or from India-Pakistan tensions. Yeah, I mean, I would probably, it's really hard for me to think that like either India or Pakistan directly benefit from just going to war, but they. That region strikes me as, like, of all the regions in the world, you know, there's lots of tensions, but of all the regions that actually literally do just the populace wants to go to war with their enemy, I feel like Pakistan and India is one of, like, the strongest ones. Like, I really do feel like those people there are just horny for war with each other at some point. But the issue is that, like, you know, in a diplomatic sense, with Trump, it did... In a sense, there is a kind of a more India turn that we're seeing with America, right? India famously used to be non-aligned and we were kind of always more with Pakistan. And now it looks like we're...
Well, I think it's important to note the role that, and this isn't conspiratorial, the role that Usha Vance plays in this administration, which is not small. People should remember that Vance is... small town boy from like heroin country or whatever it is, you know, he's supposed to be relatable. And he marries a upper caste Hindutva Usha, who then introduces him to all of the tech bros and the sort of ingratiates him with the community that you see him sort of ingratiated in, these sort of upper level Silicon Valley tech bros, crypto bros, that sort of thing. Usha carries a lot of weight. She is very powerful. Her family is very connected to the BJP as far as I know. So there's that. There is a huge connection between the Vances and India and probably this pivot to India as well as Peter Thiel.
It does kind of reveal an interesting danger. And it's really difficult to kind of talk about this in a fair way, but like I'm an immigrant myself, but there's a sort of discomfort when you have someone in power who's married to someone from a different country and how that impacts your foreign policy. We don't like to talk about it, but yeah, I mean, when you have someone who's just, you know, American, you don't really wonder about this, but now you have, you know, someone, and you know, J.D. Vance has a right to marry who he wants, but makes you wonder, right? Like, okay, you have someone in office who's married to an Indian woman, and you know, these things pop off around the world, and how does someone's wife, you know, influence their own work on foreign policy? This kind of harkens back to like for me personally, just a little personal one, like Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey. He was married to an Armenian woman, and he was, of course, very pro-Armenian in his work. Now he got into a bit of trouble as well, but that was one thing he was charged with, was he does this lobbying on behalf of Armenia because he's married to an Armenian woman. So it does kind of open you up to criticism. And yeah, I mean, this Usha Vance thing is interesting for our relations with India.
I'm sure the producer wishes that Trump would... do a nice little pivot to Slovenia for his wife, since our producers. So maybe he wants a Trump golf course or something. No, yeah, no Usha Vance for Slovenia though. So we did
the Slovenian era.
We've been trying to sort of push Melania as our Slavic queen. It's not really taking yet, but we're getting there. We're pushing it. I do want to show you this video and get your reaction once again. The defense minister of Pakistan, again in that interview where he talked about the tensions between India and Pakistan. This is further along.
You do admit, sir, that Pakistan has had a long history of backing and supporting and training and funding these terrorist organizations.
Well, we have been doing this dirty work for the United States for about three decades, you know, and West, including Britain.
So that's your argument, that...
That was a mistake, and we suffered for that. And that is why you are saying this to me, if we had not joined the war against Soviet Union and later on the war after 9/11, Pakistan's track record, you know, was not, you know, an unimpeachable track record.
We've been doing the dirty work for 30 years. And the reason why I played it, especially following what we were just talking about, the pivot to India, he almost seems sort of like miffed. We've been doing this dirty work for 30 years. We've suffered for it. And now he is one of the people that has vocally expressed that he thinks it was a false flag. It just kind of a little bit of tension between Pakistan and the United States.
And my wonder is like, where, if they lose the U.S., I mean, who do they even really, other than China, I mean, is that their only avenue left? If, say, there are, like, you know, cooler relations, they probably don't have a choice, right? They're not really friendly with Iran all that much. And I feel like they would be, they would have to make a decision of which direction they're heading into. But I don't know. I don't know if I like am convinced with this, like, you know, beyond this current administration, if there's going to be a full-time, you know, a pivot to India. I mean, it somewhat makes sense. I did see the story about how US is, was it the iPhone? But they're switching production of something, moving it from China to India. Mm-hmm. So it's like, again, there's this, you know, turn. And if, you know, I don't know enough on the economics to be like, you know, we can just move all of our trade relations from China to India. Like, I don't know how that would all break down. But yeah, I mean, there does seem to be these changing winds based on a rising India.
Well, I think they're going to find that it's not really that fertile ground. I remember watching an interview with Warren Buffett's right-hand man. And he expressed their frustration at always trying to do business in India. They had some crazy business deals that they wanted to get through. It would have really helped. And he's like, the amount of bureaucracy and the amount of crap that you have to deal with in India. He said, I believe the quote was, the good thing about India is that they look up to us. The bad thing about India is they took all of the bad parts of us and used those. And so they have all this bureaucracy and they have democracy. And he's like, we couldn't even get like a road built because like some lady was protesting for a year and they just walked away on the deal. So I don't think that they're going to find very fertile ground of for business in India. I just don't know that they, you know, it was, what was it, 2030? Then it became 2035. They were going to catch up to China. And now it's like, it probably won't happen. I don't know. I feel like we're very underprepared for what's to come. But, and one more segment I want to get to again with your opinion, especially since you are ethnically from that region. This is with Iran. We had another explosion in Iran. This one was at the port. Leading up to that, interestingly, we do remember, our listeners, I hopefully remember, that Trump called off the strikes or said he would not be joining in a strike or would not be dragged into something that Bibi began. Bibi wanted to change the strikes on Iran from October to May. Trump refused to do that. He's still in talks to reestablish the JCPOA that he coincidentally tore up. But you could read the whole interview in Time. It's free. But the important part was the interview asks, you have begun direct talks with Iran. Are you open to meeting with Iran's president or supreme leader? Trump says, yes. They said, you reportedly stopped Israel from attacking Iran's nuclear sites. Trump said, that's not right. The interviewer asked, it's not right. He said, no, it's not right. I didn't stop them, but I didn't make it comfortable for them because I think we can make a deal without the attack. I hope we can. It's possible we'll have to attack because Iran will not have a nuclear weapon. But I didn't make it comfortable for them, but I didn't say no. Ultimately, I was going to leave that choice to them, but I said I would much prefer a deal than bombs being dropped. He said, are you worried about Netanyahu? Are you worried Netanyahu will drag you into a war? He said, no. Interviewer said, let's talk about some of the issues with the universities. Trump didn't want to. So he said, by the way, he may go into a war, but we're not getting dragged in. And to clarify, the interviewer asked, the U.S. will stay out of it if Israel goes into it. Trump said, no, I didn't say that. You asked if he'd drag me in. Like I'd go in unwillingly. No, I may go in very willingly if we can't get a deal. If we don't make a deal, I'll be leading the pack. Now, I said this when Trump first, and everybody said, Trump's not going to let Bibi bomb Iran. I said, no, Trump was upset because Bibi was like, we're going to do it now. Trump was cool with the October date, but once Bibi said, no, I want to do it in May, Trump said, no, I'm still doing talks. You're not going to drag me into this. I didn't, and it was clear, like people said, it's off the table. It's not off the table. It wasn't that interview, him clarifying that this is not off the table. I'll go to war, but I'm not going to be told or dragged into it. I'm going to go. It's like, I'm going to dump you before you dump me. Or you can't fire me. I quit. I'm not being dragged in. I'm willingly going.
Yeah. And I think your analysis is 100% correct. I think for Trump, it was just about, being the one to make the decision or, choosing when and not kind of just going along with what someone else says. If you ask, a Trump supporter, this is all a brilliant strategy where he, talks with a big stick and then, negotiates his way from that without ever having to go to it. I'm a bit less, moved by this sort of strategy. I mean, this Trump, for the so-called anti-war or the president who's interested in ending these wars and not starting any new ones, his rhetoric is often very ready to go to war. We saw it with North Korea back in the day and stuff, but just when he feels like he needs to make a statement, he'll say something outlandish. He'll be fire and fury, like he said then, and leading the pack, like he says now. But I'd like to say my president said this and he means it, but it's the important thing here is that the next couple of weeks, he's playing hardball, but if they can get a deal done in this near future, that is a big win for Trump because he really can go out there and say, oh, no, I was a peacemaker. And, he really can kind of flaunt that. But if there is no deal, if Iran stalls in these next couple of weeks, the chances of the military confrontation are pretty good. I mean, I would put them, I'm not going to say all at war, but just they're, if they continue stalling on this, I feel like that it would need to come to that.
I agree. And even in the midst of all of this, a third round actually took place yesterday, a third round of talks between Iran and the United States, very quietly, between Steve Witkoff and Araghchi, and apparently technical teams, and sticking points were things like enriching uranium. And Rubio and Waltz want total dismantlement of Iran's enrichment capabilities. But Iran countered that by saying, we can go back to the Obama era. So going back to the JCPOA, which I think is more than fair. But in the midst of all of this, and I believe the deadline is May 25th. Don't quote me on that. But there's the 90-day deadline, I think, is May 25th. But in the midst of all of this, this is a little longer video. Just please bear with me.
بازه بره بگو بره داره میتره که اوه 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 یا علی نتره که اینجا Thank you.
reminiscent of Beirut for a lot of people who remember the Beirut explosion in 2020 at the Beirut port. Security firms and IRG sources have suggested improper handling of chemicals, particularly sodium perchlorate, which is an ingredient for missile fuel. There's no evidence of a foreign attack, though obviously outsiders are suspicious. The Western media was quick to report that Iran received missile fuel shipments from China. So maybe they deserved it. Is that the implication? I'm not really sure, but toxic chemicals released and the Iranian foreign minister or health ministry did declare a state of emergency. There were casualties. And the suspicious part for me is that this port, it handles 85% of Iran's container traffic, and even a minor shutdown could cripple Iran's already sort of limping economy. I love you, Iran, and I love your pragmatism and patience, but I still am not fully believing that the helicopter incident was an accident. And now we have an enormous explosion with a mass casualty scenario right as peace talks are occurring and Trump is saying strikes are not off the table. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I had read that this explosion came hours before the nuclear talks were set to resume. So, I mean, one can't help but notice that. But yeah, I mean, was it like you read the numbers? But I think like close to a quarter of the world's oil supply moves through, you know, the Straits of Hormuz, and so this is a very key area. It likely is, you know, connected to all these conflicts going on or and the potential conflicts that could flare up. But yeah, it isn't quite apparent to me, you know, who is the source of this. I don't think it's a very clear answer, but I don't believe Iran either. Come on.
Right. Sorry, Murat, I have to do it. But what are the chances? Because, you know, when the helicopter and stuff happened, there were a lot of people that were saying Azerbaijan or Israel by way of Azerbaijan or Israel or somebody inside, an insider. How infiltrated is Iran to the degree that they could be missing this sort of saboteur work?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably Israel. I don't think Azerbaijan could infiltrate like a warm jacket or whatever. Like I really think that whatever's going on in Iran is Israeli work. And you know, that the helicopter crash certainly, you know, was a big launching point for the direction that we're heading in now. I mean, a lot of things kind of went downstream of that. So yeah, I mean, to answer your question, I definitely think it was Israel's involvement in that, and it really paid off well, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, just it's unmistakable. I love and hate that Iran is always, you know, the evil Iran just doesn't want to cause any trouble. They even came out and said, you know, don't say that it was anybody else. He said rumors, social media rumors about Israeli involvement are undermining psychological security. I understand the point of them saying, you know, but very, very interesting coming out of Iran. It's sort of, you know, is it the death by a thousand cuts? Is it the, we're going to show your people that you can't protect them.
Right. And do you notice how much saving face is involved in this warfare? When Israel would do something, and we saw those strikes from Iran on Israel, and then we would always find out these were sort of symbolic strikes just meant to kind of show that you're going to retaliate, but like, you know, they're not really, it's kind of known they're not going to do anything. So there's a whole lot of show, you know, in these wars. And yeah, clearly Iran is a government that quite concerned about how it looks and who its populace and how the perceptions are of it. So they are very perception conscious to, you know, frame things in this way always whenever it happens. It's, oh, this is an accident, blah, blah. But you're absolutely right. This is a psychological move. This is a way to get the population or the regime feeling insecure on itself, right as talks are happening.
Exactly. We went over time, but I do want to give you a chance to give us some final thoughts or predictions, or maybe you have some thoughts about the trade war.
My only prediction, I'd say, I do think there's going to be an Iran deal. I think Trump's going to get a win on this one. As much as I hate to give him credit. I think, you know, kind of to wrap these up, I think Iran gets a deal before the 25th. Ukraine and Russia continues to drag, you know, in the meantime. So we'll still do a lot of shows here where, you know, that war is still ongoing without a deal. That's all I got for right now.
There will not be a deal by our next show in either case, or just we know there won't be a deal in Russia, Ukraine. Will there be
a deal for Russia, Ukraine? Yeah, no, we'll be doing a lot of shows without a deal.
All right, well, guys, please make sure you check us out on Spotify. We are there now in case you're autistic like me and you like podcasts while you're doing other things, or it just feels like somebody's talking in the background. You could have us talk in the background on Spotify. Keep your eye on Palantir as usual. If you guys did not get to see, I didn't want to play any clips because I'm afraid we'll get banned again. But if you didn't see Nick Fuentes on Alex Jones, go watch it. Go watch it and very much pay attention to when he's interrupted and the things that he says about JD Vance and Palantir. Very, very good interview. Check us out on ddgeopolitics.com. Get a GT shirt of him crashing your stock market if you want. And I'll see you guys on Thursday, because now Nick wants to go every week instead of every other week. So I'll see you guys on Thursday, and we'll both see you again on Sunday for our weekly roundup with Murat. Have a good one.